Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this edition of RealityCast, we'll have an interview with Elaine Tyler May about the history of the birth control pill. Also, coverage of the crush of media coverage on abortion and Obama, and more on a series of vampire books by a devout Mormon. Don't worry, it's still about sex, even if conservatives want to claim otherwise. So maybe you heard this story about how a woman's sense of smell changes when she's on and off the birth control pill, and how this is supposed to affect her ability to be attracted to her mate. It was from a study done on a very small group of women, and so I'm skeptical. Tracy Clark Flory has more.
Birth control pills could lead to infertility problems, a higher miscarriage risk, and ultimately the destruction of relationships when a woman goes off birth control and her pheromonal attraction to her partner changes. But scientists have yet to convincingly prove that birth control pills actually have an effect on mate choice and not just scent choice. After all, scent is only one of many potential factors that go into mate choice.
But get this, it's worse than even Clark Flory says. What these studies of human pheromones don't tell you is that humans don't really do pheromones. Rats do, and so do other animals. But humans don't have the organ that detects pheromones. So the odds that humans are reacting to pheromones is pretty damn low. I guess that means all those commercials for Axe Cologne are even stupider than you'd think. Oh boy, has abortion been in the campaign news cycle lately or what? Last week I covered the whole fuss of right-wingers, following nutbar Jerome Corsi's lead, trying to argue the absolutely ridiculous, paranoid point that Barack Obama voted for infanticide or something like that when he was in the Illinois Senate. Of course, they don't really believe this. They're just saying it because they're hoping to raise alarms until your brain shuts down. The so-called Born Alive Infant Protection Act was a stalking horse for abortion rights, and I think it's a shame that it was ever taken seriously by anyone ever. Obama finally came around to acknowledging the ridiculous accusations.
Well, and because they have not been telling the truth. And, you know, I hate to say that people are lying, but here is a situation where folks are lying. I have said repeatedly that I would have been completely and fully in support of the federal bill that everybody supported, which was to say that you should provide assistance to any infant that was born, even if it was as a consequence of an induced abortion. That was not the bill that was presented at the state level. What that bill also was doing was trying to undermine Roe versus Wade. By the way, we also had a bill, a law already in place in Illinois that ensured life-saving treatment was given to infants. So for people to suggest that I and the Illinois Medical Society, so Illinois' doctors, were somehow in favor of withholding life-saving support from an infant born alive is ridiculous.
It's not an ideal response. From the get-go, I think the better way to deal with this crap is to declare that the legislation presented by anti-woman groups should be treated as hostile and wrong unless they go to extraordinary lengths to justify themselves. As Obama says in this clip, the bill was redundant. The only reason to pass it was to attack women's reproductive rights. Meanwhile, parents who lose children through medically necessary abortions are being used as political footballs. Even taking legislation like this seriously means dragging out the exploitation of grieving parents to gain ground in the war against women. What I did like was that he singles out this lying, maudlin, exploitive tactic as the right-wing craziness that it is.
It defies common sense, and it defies imagination, and for people to keep on pushing this is offensive, and it's an example of the kind of politics that we've got to get beyond. When it's one thing for people to disagree with me about the issue of choice. It's another for people to out and out misrepresent my positions repeatedly, even after they know that they're wrong.
Of course, for days after this interview, the people pushing this accusation continued to lie about it, until various mainstream media outlets picked up the story and proved that there was no there there. Finally, Jill Stanek, the woman I covered last week who has been instrumental in pushing this story, admitted that she was mistaken about how it all went down. Obama clearly thinks that there's a possibility of making nice with some of your everyday anti-choice citizens. I mean, obviously not the Jill Stanek's of the world, who are so fetus-obsessed that they can't even pause to consider that the parents of stillborns might have feelings. But there's a huge middle section of society that's uncomfortable with abortion, but perhaps are not crazy right-wing misogynist nuts. Obama's tactic for reaching out to those people was on full display during the Saddleback Forum. Rick Warren asked the wrong question.
At what point does a baby get human rights, in your view?
You know, I understand that Rick Warren is one of those men impressed with his manly man sperm magic, but he can bite me. The idea that a fertilized egg is a baby is insulting not just to real babies, but to women. Women who make babies with 9 months of hard work creating it in their own bodies. The idea that it's a baby as soon as a man shoots, and that this is a question of when the so-called baby has human rights, is erasing women, their bodies, and their work. We are not flower pots. We are people. And the question is whether we have rights. Obama countered it with a joke.
I think that whether you're looking at it from a theological perspective or a scientific perspective, answering that question with specificity, is above my pay grade.
I'm not religious, so I believed the mainstream media types when they assured me that this answer was very offensive to the religious people out there, who are assumed to have no sense of humor. But I actually asked around with some religious people I know, and they thought the answer was very in line with a certain Christian viewpoint, which is that Obama was saying that the answer to that question was not with him, a mere man, but with God. But that's the point, isn't it? That's why we have religious freedom. If you think it's a baby when he hangs his belt at the end of the bed, go for it. But leave me the right to believe that pregnancy is real, that it actually happens, that a baby is built inside a woman for 9 months. That I have science on my side seems a little unfair, but again, the beauty of religious freedom is that I can't make you change your mind, nor can you use God to control my life. I'd like to welcome Elaine Tyler May to the program. Elaine is a professor of history and American studies at the University of Minnesota, and she's currently compiling a history of the birth control pill. Welcome to RealityCast, Elaine.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
So how did you become interested in researching the social history of the birth control pill?
Well, there's two answers to that. One of them is personal, and the other one is more professional. Personally, I grew up in a family that was very involved in the development of the birth control pill. My father was one of the clinical researchers who worked on the pill, and my mother was involved in helping to establish a number of free birth control clinics in the Los Angeles area. So I kind of grew up surrounded by the issue. And then as a historian, I've been a historian of women and the family and politics. And I've been doing work in related areas for a very long time. And the 50th anniversary of the FDA approval of the pill, which is coming up in 2010, seemed to offer a perfect opportunity to revisit the pill and see what it's meant over the last half century.
So your father was on the original research team that developed it, or...?
Well, there were a number of people who were involved in actually developing the pill. My father was a doctor who was practicing in the field of reproductive medicine, and there were a number of very famous people like John Rock and Gregory Pincus and people like that who were actually the scientists involved in first developing the pill. But then there were a number of clinical researchers who had private practices and also who had university affiliations who worked on clinical testing of the pill with their patients when the pill was first available. So he was part of that group.
What aspects of the history are you focusing your research on?
Well, my research is really going to be focused on what were the expectations for the pill, and then how did those expectations play out over time. We know there was a lot of very intense interest at the time that the pill was approved in global and also national population control, mostly global population control. There was also a lot of interest in family planning, in science being able to solve individual problems so that men and women could rationally plan when and if they wanted to have babies. So there were a lot of expectations for the pill, but liberating women was not really one of them, except for a few key feminists who were involved from the beginning, notably Margaret Sanger and Catherine McCormick, two women who were at the time in their 70s, but they really marshaled the resources for the scientific development of the pill, and they were most interested in liberating women. And then after that, when the pill came out, of course, from time to time, different problems associated with the pill became evident, and it went from being the miracle to being somewhat problematic with side effects and then dangers of blood clots and strokes. But through it all, women, especially in America, but all over the world as well, American women tended to gravitate toward the pill more than women in other countries, and they used it. They used it with their eyes open, with a clear sense of the dangers and risks and pluses and minuses, and they incorporated the pill into their lives to free them to do other things, to free them to explore sexual relationships without being married. It really came to be owned, in a sense, by the women who used it, regardless of what the initial goals were for the pill by those who developed and promoted it.
So why do you think the pill has maintained its level of popularity with women compared to other forms of
contraception? Well, it hasn't, actually. It's still very popular, but there are other forms of birth control that are more popular with different segments of the population. The pill is still the most popular form of birth control for younger women. For older women, sterilization is the most popular form of contraception, and that's true, actually, globally, the most popular form of sterilization now for married women is sterilization. But women, of course, still use the pill. Millions of women use the pill. Sometimes they use it for brief periods of time during their lives. Sometimes they take the pill and then switch to something else. It's definitely now one of many available contraceptive methods that is widely used, but it's definitely not the only one.
Are you looking much into the hostility that the pill has caused in some segments of society?
Well, yes, there's been hostility from a number of sources. Initially, there was a lot of suspicion and hostility from the black community, who feared that it was another means of white people to control and limit the numbers of black people, especially in the black power movement. There was a resolution among certain organizations in that movement to officially condemn the birth control pill. But there, the black women, of course, even though they knew that there may be some ulterior motives on the part of some promoters of the pill, nevertheless, they wanted birth control. They wanted effective birth control. So there, too, black women used the pill for their own purposes, regardless of suspicions about white motives and even hostility from some of their black male peers. As far as the right wing is concerned, there was, of course, some opposition based on fears that the pill was going to unleash sexual promiscuity. The most consistent opposition, of course, has been and continues to be the Catholic Church, but Catholic women use the pill in pretty much the same proportion as non-Catholic women, so it really hasn't stopped the use of birth control among Catholics. Recently, there's been a new hostility to any kind of contraception by the far right wing, who is against sex education and against making contraceptives available to young people because they believe that they shouldn't be engaging in sex. But of course, abstinence-only plans have been proven to be completely worthless. They do absolutely nothing to cut down on the numbers of unwanted pregnancies and sexual activity among young people. So there is, of course, hostility from a lot of different segments in the population. But nonetheless, the pill and birth control more generally just continues to be widely used by the women who want to use it, which is most women who are sexually active.
What's some of the most surprising stuff that you've uncovered?
Well, one thing I found is that men actually had a whole series of interesting responses to the pill. And looking at the media has been interesting to see how the popular culture handles the matter of the pill. Popular culture, well, I'll put it this way. The scientific and political community was very interested in population control. The popular culture gave evidence of no interest in that issue, but the popular culture was much more interested in the whole issue of freeing women in particular from the risks of unwanted pregnancy. And it's been interesting to look at the way popular culture has reflected attitudes towards the use of the pill. As far as men are concerned, it's been interesting to look at the media as it's directed toward men to see how those messages were promoted, especially in places like Playboy and other male magazines, and also more generally among the scientific community regarding the development of a pill for men, which, of course, we know has never happened, even though there have been promises of a male pill just around the corner for the last half century. There's still no male pill. So those are kind of interesting aspects of the pill that I was not as aware of when I've been reading about it, and hasn't been covered as much in the histories of birth control more generally.
Was the male-centered press largely enthusiastic?
Playboy was, but not necessarily always for reasons that women would be pleased. I mean, Hugh Hefner insisted that he was a feminist before feminists were feminists, a little bit disingenuous, although he did believe in promoting women's rights, and he was avidly in favor of birth control and abortion rights. On the other hand, he didn't seem to have very much sympathy. Playboy in general didn't have much sympathy for women who had trouble with the pill, who had side effects and that sort of thing. What would be consistent, of course, with the Playboy philosophy was liberating both men and women's sexuality so that there could be sex without any negative consequences and without any need for anybody to take responsibility, that meaning men, of course. It would be women's responsibility to be on the pill, and that would make sex carefree for the men, if not for the women.
So I discovered your research when a call went out for submissions or for information from people who'd like to tell their stories about using the pill. Would you like to repeat that call?
I would definitely love to do that. I would be most delighted if anyone out there would like to tell me their story. If they could send me an email, that would be fantastic. My email address is Elaine Tyler May, one word, ElaineTylerMay, at gmail.com. So please, anyone out there, if you've used the pill or even if you haven't used the pill, if you have any thoughts about it, any experiences with it, any ideas, any opinions, please send them my way. I would be delighted to include your perspective in my book.
Now listen up. Now gather around.
Our very own Sarah Seltzer wrote about the Twilight Vampire series a month ago, and she seems to have preempted a media frenzy. It's because there's a movie based on the series coming out, and to make it even more media-friendly, the author is a devout Mormon, housewife. Is it really fair to call a published writer a housewife? That would make me a housewife, and I object to that description. But I suppose housewife does make her massive fame and fortune less threatening. Here's some CNN coverage.
Screaming fans! sold-out appearances, even a bodyguard for protection. Meet the literary world's newest rock star.
Please welcome Stephanie Meyer!
Stephanie Meyer penned the vampire-centric Twilight book series and is being hailed by some as the next J.K. Rowling.
There's never going to be another J.K. Rowling. You know, I'm a huge fan of hers, and that's just a phenomenon that's not going to reoccur.
Meyer, a Mormon mother of three, was a 29-year-old housewife when she had a life-changing dream about vampires.
It was so cool to take this dream and make it into something that was real, that I could revisit.
Of course, most of us with even the slightest glimmer of sophistication can tell you why the vampire thing versus the Mormon housewife thing is a little startling. And it's not because vampires are scary. It's because vampires are a classic symbol of sublimated sexuality. And, as Sarah said, the timing is perfect because girls nowadays are getting a lot more messages about how they have to be sexy without wanting sex than they were when I was a girl. The plots of the book reflect this tension.
A Mormon writing about blood-sucking vampires, it's an interesting dichotomy, isn't it?
It is, and actually, until you get to the fourth book, it's actually rather chaste. And while it is about passion and love, it's very innocent.
Of course, the heroine is super desirable, so it's a way for girls to fantasize about being what they're told they have to be, chaste in behavior, but visually stimulating for passing men. After all, pretty much no one strikes the perfect balance in real life. Naturally, the wingnuts are getting in on the action, because who likes impressing impossible standards on teenage girls more than a wingnut? Concerned Women for America actually had a podcast praising the book for pushing an abstinence message. You know, despite all the penetrative and sensual biting that vampires like to get into.
This is the final and last novel in a series of novels, and all of them have portrayed abstinence in a very, very positive way. And people are looking on and saying, what in the world is going on? But this author is a Mormon mother with three children, and her story is really capturing the romance of teen love without any sex, and showing the excitement of first love and the fact that glances and touching hands and sitting close, looking at each other across the room, these kinds of teenage experiences can be very romantic.
God, you don't even get close dancing or closed mouth kisses? Well, of course not. The point of this exercise is to set the standard so high that pretty much every girl is bound to fail and then hate herself for being a dirty girl. What the Ladies Against Women don't mention in this interview, but my readers at Pandagon alerted me to, was that the main character gets pregnant pretty much right away after she gets married in the series. And it's, as you might expect, a maudlin tome to feminine self-sacrifice, with the baby and then the birth nearly killing her, because it's demon spawn. But who cares if it's demon spawn? The important thing is that women learn that their bodies don't belong to them, but should always be subjugated to the needs of the patriarchy. And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. The campaign season skips silly and goes straight to surreal edition. You know you're hitting rock bottom when you have to trot out Ann Coulter to echo your nonsense, as was done on this Obama and late-term abortion thing on Sean Hannity's show. If you're sensitive, I suggest you tune out, because what she says is vicious and heartless. Like everyone else pumping this thing, she completely forgets that women who need late-term abortions are human beings who've suffered a great deal of pain.
Of course it's infanticide. Yeah, he's for a woman's right to choose through the fourth trimester. And even Barbara Boxer, whom until now was the most staunchly pro-abortion senator, even she spoke in favor of this bill. I mean, this is a child that is not bothering the woman anymore, is not going to make her depressed or affect her health. It's out of the woman's body. They tried to kill it, but somehow the baby made it out alive, sometimes missing an arm, but alive. And Barack Obama wants the doctors, you know, chasing it through the delivery room to make sure it gets killed.
Okay, this is what I mean when I say that their entire worldview is a fantasy. I realize, since I read anti-choice literature all the time, that they think that zygotes have deep, thoughtful lives, but I was unaware that the fantasy extended to thinking that a 20-week-old fetus could get up and run around a room. Coulter, of course, is a heartless person and doesn't even pause to consider how it might feel to be someone who suffered a medically necessary late-term abortion of a wanted pregnancy when she spouts off like this. Even Dennis Prager, who is willing to state any kind of right-wing lie, is taken aback and skeptical about this, as he should be, because it's all lies.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.